This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Scientists have been trying to trace the actual origins of the virus that causes COVID for a while now. For a time, we were thinking it was possibly partially engineered as part of a lab experiment, but there's some new information in now. So let's go to Dr. Keith Jerome, who is head of the UW Virology Lab. What do we know now, Dr. Jerome?
Well, Dave, first of all, I think this is going to be the next chapter in a story that's going to go on for a while. Like you said, we want to understand where the virus came from because we'd like to be able to prevent it next time. If it came from a market with live animals, that's important to know for controlling it. And of course, we're interested in, did it come from a lab? Because that's also a really bad thing and we need to know. So this new paper from a doctor named Michael Worabi, who's at the University of Arizona, and he's an evolutionary biologist, a really strong scientist. And he basically looked through as much data as he could find from, WHO reports, scientific papers, media reports, and basically tried to really piece together what happened around the Wuhan market. The idea was that maybe we were kind of tricked by this market thing because the word got out that it was coming from the market. So we looked there hard and that's where we found all the cases. And basically he looked at cases that were found before word got out. So kind of trolled around different hospitals and essentially found that of about 20 early patients, 10 had something to do with this market, particularly places that had some live animals. It's something called a raccoon dog and they can carry coronaviruses. So it sort of fit that the market was there. And he also found out a little bit more about this so-called first patient that kind of made all this complicated because there was an idea that this 41-year-old man had COVID on December 8th and was the first case. Turns out that on December 8th, what he actually had was some tooth problems and his COVID symptoms started on the 16th. So he wasn't the first case. Uh-huh. That's important because he had nothing to do with the market. So anyway, this puts now the first case is a vendor at the market December 11th. And that's the earliest case we know. So it makes us think that the market is more likely the start of this. In my opinion, it's certainly not a cut and dried case. And that's why I say I think we may get some more chapters as people keep looking at this and try to figure this out. We sort of peel back the layers of this onion.
Okay, but then it sounds like the live animal market is back at the top of the suspect list here. And if that's true, that this is where it started, do we have detectives at these animal markets looking for the next one?
Well, these live animal markets are generally not here, Dave, right? They're not in the United States for the most part. And mm-hmm. So,
but I thought we had a cooperative arrangement with China and I would assume other countries as well, but certainly China because of its huge population.
Well, sure. And we do. But I think we also know that the situation in China is different from here, right? I mean, here we have folks like you and the media and scientists who all kind of work independently and get to disagree and have their ideas and research them and try to get to the truth. Things are a lot more controlled there, Dave, right? So,
yeah,
you know, there are no samples from those animals, for example. Those were all destroyed. The area where they were was all disinfected before any sampling was done. So we really don't know for sure. And it was just done differently. So, yeah, there are these groups. Are they allowed to do it as well as they could in another setting? Probably not.
And we still think that the raccoon dog got it from a bat, was bitten by a bat.
Well, again, that would be the hypothesis that it somehow got between bats. So we know that bats carry coronaviruses. We know that bats have coronaviruses that are very, very similar to SARS-CoV-2. But there are some important differences. So the prevailing idea has been that there must have been some sort of intermediate species, that it went from the bat, like you said, into something and then into people. Mm-hmm. Was it the raccoon dog? You can make a nice story of it. Is there proof? No. You have lots and lots of these animals in a confined area. Maybe one has been, let's just say, as a hypothetical, has been exposed to a bat. Now these raccoon dogs are housed together by mm-hmm. a vendor. They're passing it between each other. The vendor is caring for them, handling them, and so forth. So is the vendor bitten by them, licked by them, just breathing the air? I mean, those are the big questions we really don't know. I think live markets are inherently dangerous for this sort of thing, Dave. You know, this is a recurring story. I'm not sure that there's a way to make these live markets be safe ideas, frankly. I think it's a very difficult thing.
That's important to know then. So we're talking about situations where animals and people are in fact crowded together. We're not talking about, this is not the thing then that would happen to an individual pet infecting
someone. It seems very, very unlikely. Is it impossible? No, but I wouldn't worry about a bat biting my dog. That is the last thing,
okay, good.
Virus or not, that I'm going to worry about for the rest of the day.
So since the vaccine came out, we're also seeing a bunch of new therapeutic drugs for people who either didn't get vaccinated or who have breakthrough infections or for whatever reason. And this is a big deal, right?
I think it's a huge deal. We've seen the hesitation around the vaccine. I mean, my goodness, the easiest way for this or most health conditions is to prevent them first. Usually that's what people argue for, but we've seen a lot of hesitancy around vaccine, unfortunately. And, you know, once you get COVID, you've heard these stories, people want to get the vaccine and it's too late at that point. And then you've got things like the monoclonal antibodies and so forth that are incredibly expensive and you have to get an IV. And these new drugs are exciting because they work really well and they're pills. Mm-hmm. So you can actually take them by mouth for a couple of days and they prevent, in the early data, they prevent the risk of hospitalization, depending on the drug, between 50 and 90%.
Wow.
So they keep people out of the hospital and they keep people from dying. And it's a huge advantage either for breakthrough cases here, people who haven't been vaccinated, and especially across the world where people still don't have access to these vaccines.
Now, how soon do you have to take the pill? Do you have to, do you need to take it after getting a test and before you get symptoms, or can you take it even after you've felt the symptoms?
So for almost any antiviral, the sooner the better. And that's clearly the case here. So we're thinking around the first 4 or 5 days after symptoms start, and sooner's better. So I think what you're going to see is these get approved and really rolled out widely. If people are at an elevated risk for COVID, they've got a cough, they've got some reason to think about that they may have COVID, get that test.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's positive, you can get on these drugs and hopefully prevent this from becoming a life-threatening illness, which it certainly can today.
And these will be prescription drugs. This is not something you can just waltz into the drugstore and get.
No, these will be prescription drugs. Yeah. Hopefully there'll be a nice, easy pathway to getting them, but they won't be just provided over the counter.
Okay. So good idea. Vaccine first, then the pill, anything to avoid the ventilator.
You bet.
Yeah. Dr. Keith Jerome, University of Washington Virology Lab. Dr. Jerome, thank you. Talk to you next month.
God, I do enjoy talking with you, but as I always say, I hope we get this behind us.
Choke Points, brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. Do you move over a lane when you see a disabled car or a tow truck or a police officer? Tow truck drivers are begging the legislature for more protection because it's been a deadly year for them on the roads, and Chris has the story.
Corey Wells has been a tow truck driver for 31 years. He was nearly killed on the job, pinned between his tow rig and the semi that he was hooking up to when a driver slammed into the back of the disabled truck.
I'm a walking, talking ghost.
6 weeks ago, he lost a 33-year-old employee who was recovering a car on I-5 near Kalama. Raymond Mitchell, a father of four, was killed when a log truck going a little too fast ran off the road across the fog line and hit his rig.
I shouldn't be here today. I shouldn't be that emotional to you people, but I am. I love what I do, and I want to come home to my wife tonight. We need your help.
Wells asked the Senate Transportation Committee last week to imagine what it would be like for them to have 70-mile-an-hour traffic whizzing by them as they work with only inches between them and the traffic.
We're not just that guy across the street. We're your neighbors. We're the guys that come out and rescue when your car breaks down. We're those guys. We want to go home at night. We have families. They love us.
Another tow truck driver, Art Anderson, was killed on I-5 near Kelso in April. He was helping a family with its disabled car when a suspected drunk driver slammed into them. Anderson and two members of the family were killed. There have also been two other injury crashes in Washington over the last year involving tow truck drivers working on the side of the road. AAA reports 24 tow truck drivers lose their lives on the job every year in America. The Towing and Recovery Association of Washington is asking the legislature for ways to improve safety, including the ability for them to use different colored lights on their trucks to make them more visible. Right now, they can use yellow or red lights, but drivers like Wells want to have blue lights as well. He believes drivers pay more attention to blue lights, especially in the dark. They, of course, would only be able to use them when actively working a recovery. Wells believes drivers would be more likely to follow Washington's slow down, move over law if they saw those blue lights ahead on the freeway, thus making things a little bit safer. He would also like to see drivers have the ability to put cameras in their trucks that could record drivers who whiz by them, failing to obey the law. Those could be eventually used to find the offending drivers, not unlike cameras in school bus paddles. He would also like more funding for signs about the slow down, move over law. And since we're talking about it, what do you know about the slowdown move over law? It requires that you move over a lane if it is safe to do so when passing any emergency or construction zone. Basically, anything that has flashing lights on the side of the road, you're supposed to get over a lane if it is safe to do so. That zone goes for about 200 feet on either side of the entire area. Now, if you can't safely get over, you are required to slow your speed to 10 miles an hour below the posted speed limit while going by. This is a non-negotiable $214 fine if you are ticketed. While not required, I believe it's a pretty good practice to get over if you can while passing any stopped car on the freeway. I want you to put yourself in that broken down driver's shoes. What would you like other drivers to do while you're maybe investigating a flat tire or a kid that's having a problem or something like that? Get over. And I think the tow truck drivers here have a valid point. They're out there in the dark doing a lot of things, and I think extra lights might help them. A different color light might trigger something in you, especially in the dark, to get over, because I see a lot of people not paying attention to that slow down, move over law, which is the law, and I don't think a lot of people realize that. It's not optional. If you can, you got to get over.
I told you my most terrifying moment was, it was a long time ago, but I was driving my little Honda Civic. Express lanes, Ship Canal Bridge, timing belt breaks, car stops. Ugh. And so you know, I was able to coast over to the shoulder, but you're there waiting for a tow truck in the middle of this bridge with traffic whizzing by. It's terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, if you've never stood by the side of the freeway, and just as a person, I've been there, you know, on a variety of reporting things, like with the state patrol or whatnot. It is terrifying. And all we're asking is just get over. Give us a little bit more room. And also, if you're distracted, you know, that's another recipe or impaired. That's where a lot of these things happen. And speed as well, where you can just, I mean, there are inches to spare here sometimes with those rigs. And I think it's only, would make sense to give them a little extra room. And just to remind everybody of the slow down, move over law. I mean, law enforcement, construction workers, whatever, they all want to go home at the end of the night. And there's no reason. If you've got room, get over.
The other thing is that with gas prices the way they are, you have to understand that you can actually save real money by not driving at 80 miles an hour, where you're spending a good chunk of your gas, of course, except if it's you in Montana, Chris, I should make that exception.
No, you shouldn't make that exception.
Because you're spending a ton of gas just pushing air out of the way. I mean, wind resistance becomes incredible the faster you go.
Yeah, and especially when it's windy, which it is there in Montana in places. But yeah, I say this a lot, Dave, and this is something that has been kind of a passion of mine since I took over this traffic transportation thing, is to put yourself in the shoes of the other people when you're driving. I mean, would you cut off your mother? Yeah. Would you cut off your wife or your husband or your kids? You don't automatically assign an intent to what that person is doing. Oh, they cut me off. Oh, maybe they were distracted, forgot where they were. Their kid was yelling in the back. They got a call. Yeah. Don't assign intent to them and just give them a break. So I think we all need to be a little bit less selfish behind the wheel. And I think we'd all get around a little bit better. And maybe some of these tow truck drivers would make it home at night if we had kind of thought that way.
Right. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Hannah Scott joins us now. She's a woman who's been a pillar of the community for more than 30 years, a mother, an advocate for youth and community, and a big believer in police accountability. And last week, Reverend Harriet Walden says she was the victim of a hate crime. She spoke exclusively with Car Radio's Hannah Scott about what happened and put out a call to action. Hannah, what went on here?
It was really a shock. She was walking down the street, and a person screaming racial slurs at her, ended up throwing something at her, hit her in the back, and it was a shock. Says, if you don't know who the Reverend Harriet Walden is, she's been around, again, for 30 years and has been an advocate. She's an activist. She is Omari Salisbury's mother. She started Mothers for Police Accountability, is what it's called now. It used to be Mothers Against Police Harassment, I believe. That started in the 90s. Her and Omari got together and did a interview about that back in the 90s. It had to do with an incident involving his brothers and himself.
It was August 5th, 1990. My brother, three friends were coming back from the Black Community Festival. It was the last evening. And it's right when they were turning the corner of 29th and Jackson coming to our house. The officer, he said he saw a burnt out license plate lamp. And he decided to bust a U-turn and stop him right there in front of our house. So my brother's two friends got out the car and came into the yard.
Eventually, four boys was arrested. And roughed up, two of the boys that was kind of roughed up was my sons.
14 officers, 8 patrol cars came to the scene.
Because of that incident, we formed an organization called Mothers Against Police Harassment.
And 30 years later,
we're filming this to go out to the community about the SPOG meeting that's coming up December 5th. And my job is to inspire the community to come out. This is your opportunity. We worked hard for this, and especially the young people. Oh, boy, we want to see young people show up and get your voice heard and talk about the police contract and the things that you want, the changes you want to see in Seattle.
So that's what she's been doing for 30 years. And she is really, like I said in the lead there, a pillar of the community, the Black community, especially in the Central District. She couldn't believe it. She was walking down to Omari's studio last Thursday, and this is what happened.
Just before 3:30, and I parked there in the garage on the southeast side of First and Columbia. And I got out the car, and I was getting ready to cross. I mean, the light had changed red, and I was getting ready to cross. There was a lady in front of me, a Caucasian lady. She had an umbrella because it was raining. He came speeding down the hill in the bus lane, and the lady, she jumped out the way, and then I started across, and then he just kept revving his car like he wanted to hit me.
That's when she says things got personal.
You know, and I got across the street, he rolled down his window, and he had some choice words to say, and I had them to say back to him, and he kept going with the choice words, and then after a while, I said, well, you know what? I'm going down the street, and I'm going to find my son. He's a police officer. That's what I said, and I started walking away. That's when he hit me.
The Reverend says it was an absolute shock.
He threw a motor oil container full of motor oil, and he hit me in my back. And in my small of a back, I've never been hit in my life. So I was stunned. I didn't fall, praise goodness. And then I tried to step out there to get the license plate of his car, and he revved up. And so I kind of jumped back between the two cars. And then he sped off. Ran the red light at First in Marion, and I was still kind of stunned, but I made it across the street on the other side of First there, called my granddaughter. She came right out, and there was another lady across the street. She saw it, and she ran across the street to help me, and she gave my granddaughter a description of the car, and we gave that to the police.
And now the police are investigating this as a potential hate crime, looking for that driver.
Called Black people. And a lot of people are concerned, well, you know who I am. Well, he didn't know who I am, who I was. He just didn't like melanin. I mean, and so we have to talk about how hate is really, I mean, I grew up in segregation, so I understand hate. I mean, I'm not a newcomer to hate. We've been the recipients of non-provoked violence in America for 400 years. We don't have to be doing nothing and get ourselves in harm's way.
So she wants to use this incident to change all of that.
I think that we have to talk about that here in Seattle. I mean, we have to decide what kind of city we want to be. There's been quite a few hate crimes going on here in Seattle and in King County, especially after COVID. The hate has not ever solved the problem.
One thing she says she is exceptionally grateful for.
My blessing in all of this is that he did not have a further weapon, because he was close enough for me. If he had a gun, then, you know, we would have been writing an obituary for Miss Harriet.
But it's an amazing thing to talk to the 75-year-old woman who had never experienced anything like that. As you heard her say, never been hit in her whole life, was completely shocked walking downtown by herself to be hit with a full can of this oil in the small of her back. And she said that it just, in talking to her, it just, I expected her to say, you know, we need better, you know, prosecutions or better something in, you know, the criminal justice kind of arena. And she is on board with prosecuting anybody behind any hate crime. But what she sees here is an opportunity and a call to action to make a difference in the world and change the things that we've been seeing. Her call to action is this.
You know, one of the things that we could do is do public service announcements like they used to do in Santa Barbara. Like, it is not 10 o'clock at night. Do you know where your children are? We can do public service. Now, it would cost nothing for the media to do a public service announcement. But people believe that this is the only way. It is not the only way. You can learn this is not the only way to do this. And we have to acknowledge that America is a violent country. And I mean, look what happened to the natives and look what happens to us. I mean, unprovoked violence. But that doesn't mean you can't get on the road to change.
And to start that road to change, she says, you have to start with the young people.
Let's start with the children and say, hey, you know what? We can do this. We can raise up a generation of children to absolutely understand what unconditional love is, how to take responsibility for all their thoughts, deeds, and actions. We can do this, but we have to stand up and somebody has to lead the way. And then say, oh, let's do this. We can. We don't have to be mean.
I asked if she was the person to lead this, and she said she will do her part based on what's happened to her. She's going to call all the local radio stations and talk to them about doing PSAs, about just speaking out. She says nobody speaks up when these things happen. They just, you get it reported in the news maybe, and then you move on. That's it. She wants to change that.
Did she get the license number?
She did not, because the guy revved his vehicle. Yeah. So
she got a description, right?
There's a description, yep. And I believe the woman who was standing by saw a partial and had a description of the car that was given to her granddaughter, mm-hmm. who then gave that to police. So they are looking. I know she's also talking with the prosecutor's office about some resources for hate crimes for herself. She, by the way, is doing well. She went to the clinic, had got herself checked out. I talked to her yesterday, so a few days after the fact.
She sounded full of fire in your interview there.
She always is, yes.
And I believe in teaching love as well, but I also believe in catching that guy. So does she, to be clear.
Okay. She does. She just wants to.
Right downtown, they've got to be a bunch of security cameras there mm-hmm. that they can start looking at.
Absolutely. So, yeah, if you have those cameras, look at your cameras and check it all out. But also think about what she said. That's what she wants to use this moment for.
Kyrados, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. The Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft, a University of Michigan football player. He's doing big things this Thanksgiving. He bought 100 turkeys to give to families in a community over the weekend, the Ypsilanti community.
Ypsilanti.
Thank you. Yes. How do you guys know that?
I've been to Michigan.
And I've been to the state prison of Southern Michigan in Ypsilanti.
But that's a long story.
I've got some living to do. The Ypsilanti community over the weekend. Linebacker Blake Corum tells the Detroit News what inspired him to do this.
Giving back to the community means everything to me. Life's way bigger than football. And so I feel like one of my purposes in life is just helping others. So that's the main reason why I came out here to give out turkeys.
Corum didn't do this with his scholarship money or grant money, but with some of the money he made from his name, image, and likeness. Yeah, you remember this story. Back in July, the NCAA made a game-changing rule where student athletes can make money out of their likeness. Corum's high school and college teammate, Nikai Hill Green, also joined
him. Engagement is just something we have in common, and it's really important for both of us. And really just doing stuff for the community because we didn't get here alone. Someone helped us down the line, so we want to help someone else get to the next level or just make their year.
And when Corum was asked if he could be at the Thanksgiving table with the families he gave turkeys to, he said,
"God and I were talking about, we're there in spirit. You know, I don't even want to be there. I want them to have their own time, their family time."
An often generous thing. Often one of the biggest questions student athletes are asked is, what are they going to do with the money they receive from this game-changing rule? Well, this is something you can do with it. It's a kind thing. It's also how you can inspire brands to give you more money when you're using it to give back. Isn't that nice?
It is nice.
There's a big fight over whether students should make money off of their image and likeness. And this is the result of allowing students to have that freedom. They choose to use the money in a good way.
So they don't go crazy. Mm-hmm. They do nice things instead.
They buy 100 turkeys to give Thanksgiving to families. Hello.
from the Gee and Ursula show, which starts at 9 right here on Cairo Radio. Here is G. Scott. And first of all, I understand we should congratulate you on your engagement. So congratulations.
Yes, yes sir. I decided to walk the blade.
Yeah?
Walk the blade.
Walk the blade, as opposed to walk the plank. Right, I've heard of walking the plank.
Right, right. This walk the blade, you know, it's a little tougher. Any wrong move, any mess up, it could go bad.
Did you have any doubt she would say yes?
You always got some doubt. You don't ever know. You know what I'm saying? I mean, look.
I mean, you've done this a few times. You think you got the nerves out of there, man.
There it was. Wow. There it was. Hey, touche.
Hey, it just shows that love never dies, right? Your heart can still be repaired and built up, and you got that nervousness as you, you know, ask your soulmate to marry you. Good for you, G. I'm happy for you.
Now, I've seen one where the woman, she said no to the man. I've personally seen that myself. Yes, I did.
You witnessed that?
One of the most awkward times of my life.
That's why my advice my parents gave to Chris, my husband, was don't do it publicly. Not that they had any doubt, but just because, like, you never want to put a woman in a situation where she feels like she needs to please the crowd. I mean, good for that woman for saying no despite the audience. But, yeah, like, engagements are a private thing. I think in your picture, it looked like just a few people were around.
Yeah. Now, I will say this, as far as you asked with nervous. Yeah, you're still nervous. Like, yeah, anything going. What I was more nervous of was the daddy saying no. You feel me? Like, that could be, you know what I'm saying? You go to the dad, like, well.
That all proper and ask the dad for permission?
Hey,
that is so old school that women are still giving away.
Now so here's the thing. Here's the thing. That is the first time I've ever done it.
Oh.
How about that?
So you're hoping this time's the charm, huh?
Yeah.
Switching things up?
Let me do it the right way.
I love that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And then
When's the wedding?
I'm going to try to get it done in 22.
All right.
Yeah, nice little destination and keep it simple.
All right. Basically, you're telling us we won't be able to make it.
Yeah, you guys, you'll see it on Facebook.
Yeah. So you're headed off to the Ohio State-Michigan game.
Going to the big house, big rivalry game. It is going to be big. Winner takes all. It is going to be pandemonium. I'm looking forward to it.
So are you going to get nervous watching your son in this high-pressure environment? I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than this.
Yeah, you're always nervous because you're just nervous of any moment, anything can happen. I mean, towards the end of the game last week, he got in the game and there was a pass thrown to him. And I got nervous that he was going to catch it and he caught it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're always nervous. So, but I'm just looking forward to it because the last time I was at a Ohio State-Michigan game in the big house actually was almost like 25 years ago. Yeah, about 25 years ago, I was there. And so it was just no big deal. You're just hanging out. But now I think I'm there in a different type of capacity. I'm looking forward to being a part of that.
I can't imagine it because I used to get nervous watching my daughters in fifth grade soccer games. And you're going to be there with how many does that place hold? That's like 110,000 people.
Yep, 110 in there. So it's going to be. And there is like. There's real bad blood between the two. So I'll tell you what I'm really nervous of, if I want to be honest. I'm not as nervous of watching them play or how the game's going to play out. I'm just nervous like, hey, can everybody just be cool? You know what I mean? Like, I don't – you see me in my Ohio State stuff, be cool, fan. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want no problems. I don't want anything. I'm going to have little Lillian with me. You know, she's barely 5 foot tall. Just leave
little
us alone.
Little Lillian?
Yeah.
That's so cute. Is that your pet name for her?
Oh, well, no. I just said it just now for the show.
Oh, it's so cute. I love that.
It's just for the show. And then, I'm hope I get a chance to see the pillow fight that's going to happen here in the state of Washington, though. That's going to be
good. Pillow fight?
The pillow fight.
The little cougar game.
The apple cup.
Yeah.
The cougar versus game. The Huskies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, hello, you did that. Pow, pow, pow.
Right.
So Dave, they got you. They got you. That tickled you, huh?
This is. We're sort of like the amateur leagues here now compared to where you play. Yeah, we're just sort of
yeah. But yeah, other than that, I'm looking forward to Thanksgiving, of course. Happy Thanksgiving to you guys. Before I go, I just need to know, what's one meal that you have to have? What's one side or one thing you have to have on Thanksgiving? What do you have to have?
Green bean casserole with breadcrumbs on top.
Oh, my goodness. That is the what are you going to say, Colleen?
I don't like green bean casserole. That's okay. That's Dave's thing. I have to have my mother's fattening potatoes. It's like a cheesy, creamy potato.
And that's what it's
like
called,
scalloped
too.
Potatoes, but potatoes. Better. But it's called fattening potatoes. The original recipe had 2 sticks of butter in it, and she's made it more healthy.
Only 1 3/4.
Dave, I just want to tell you that I am not shocked at all that you need green bean casserole. Not at all. As a matter of fact, Dave, that's you right. look like you
I look
want
like
green bean casserole.
Don't I, though? G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo. Thanks, G.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Congratulations again.
All right.
The Seattle City Council passed a budget focused on investing big in affordable housing and homelessness. But one council member warns that the city could be in big financial trouble if things don't go its way in an upcoming legal battle. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Coming in at just over $7 billion, the council passed budget includes around $1.6 billion in general fund dollars, with more than $200 million of that being used for affordable housing and homeless projects, including a little over $15 million in new investments in homelessness services that the new Regional Homelessness Authority will administer, and $165 million for the creation of new affordable rental housing. A big victory for Council Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda.
This Council budget rightly invests in more emergency reserves while prioritizing spending limited public dollars to serve, care for, and support working families in our local economy. Thanks very much to the foresight of this council to continue to support the implementation plan from the Jumpstart Progressive Revenue. We are able to lead with progressive values in this budget, act with urgency to ward off any deep cuts, and protect our most vulnerable in this time of compounding public health crises.
But the Downtown Seattle Association not as thrilled, saying in a statement, Seattle voters sent a clear message earlier this month that they want city government to prioritize addressing homelessness and improving public safety. Unfortunately, they say, the City Council's 2022 budget misses the mark on both fronts. Despite being part of the largest budget in city history, it is incomplete with no clear strategy to meaningfully address these issues and support the recovery of downtown Seattle. The president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, though, not as dismayed with this budget. Mike Solon issuing a statement this morning saying the City Council's vote on the budget is the beginning of a great political pivot away from unreasonable activism and back to the moderate policies that made Seattle the Emerald City. Even those behind the Defund the SPD movement seem to be pleased in their statement, saying that they're celebrating as they see 2 straight years of divestment or shifting dollars away from SPD into community priorities, such as $10 million that was invested in this budget to invest in the work needed to look at alternatives to policing. Public Safety Committee Chair Lisa Herbold on the police budget.
This budget makes strategic investments in public safety so that law enforcement can respond to calls that only they are qualified to handle. That includes fully funding the Seattle Police Department plan to hire 125 additional police officers, more community service officers, and technology resources necessary to support alternatives to police response and consent decree compliance.
Outgoing Council President Lorena Gonzalez also weighing in.
Even though by admission, we did not achieve across the board success, including the close defeat of my abrogation amendment that would have advanced transparency and budget accountability within the police department. But alas, the future council will continue to struggle with holding the police department accountable to spending within its limits, in large part because the failure of my abrogation amendment.
So, Hannah, what is the big financial crisis that could happen?
The Jumpstart payroll tax that was approved a couple of years ago by the council funds a good portion of this budget, more than $200 million, and it's tied up in a legal proceeding, and that's upcoming. So Lisa Herbold took the time yesterday in closing remarks to say, look, we need for that to be a victory if anything is to go wrong. And she kind of made a point to say that the current city attorney is doing the briefs on it, and then the new city attorney will be taking over for the city, Ann Davison, when that case goes to actual trial. I don't know if there was any intention behind what she said as far as making that point, but whatever the case, she did say that if they were to lose that case, that it would be impossible to not have to make across-the-board cuts in the city government.
Now, the jumpstart tax is a payroll tax imposed on companies of a certain size, and it's based on salaries highly paid.
Right, highly paid earners.
So they pay a fee, but how... Now, how was that not considered an income tax?
Well, that's why they're in court, Dave.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it looks a lot like it. I mean, it's not imposed the same way an income tax would be imposed. It's imposed on the employers based on people's salaries, and the law tells them you shall not reduce the salaries to pay this tax, and yet... You know, the money has to come from somewhere. So that's
right. Yeah.
When is this going to go to trial then?
I believe it's at the briefings are due December 15th. So I believe it's in the end of January is when this should go to trial.
Okay. And one more thing. If it turns out the city loses, because they've already started collecting money from this, right?
No.
Well, they have not. So the budget is based on money that has not been collected?
I don't believe they've been able to collect yet, although I might be mixing my taxes, so don't hold me to that. It's possible that they do.
Question is going to be, if they've been collecting money and the decision goes against them, do they have to refund that money they already collected under the illegal tax?
Yeah, and I don't know. I think I don't know. I don't think that they have to. I know in the capital gains tax situation, if they are to start to collect, I don't believe they have to. It goes into a trust. So I'm not sure what it is at the city government level for jumpstart payroll. I'm not 100% that they've started to collect that yet, though. Yeah. I don't think they have.
All right, Hannah, thank you.
You betcha.
On Tuesdays, we take you to Washington, D.C., live to the Washington Post and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold. I just wanted to start with the polls to make sure that I'm reading them correctly. But the last time I checked the Real Clear Politics average, Joe Biden's approval rating was in the 30s.
It's been real bad. I mean, he has had, starting in August, between Afghanistan and gas prices and the gridlock on the Hill, it's been a bad few months for Biden. I have not checked it in a week or so. Last I saw, he was slightly ahead of where Trump was at this point. But again, that's not... You know, every other president beyond Trump was doing much better at this point.
I also, keep hearing speculation that he might not run. I'm talking about Biden, but that's not serious. Nobody's really paying attention to that.
Oh, people are talking about it. You know, Biden himself has said that he is going to run. Jen Psaki, the press secretary, said yesterday that he's going to run. You know, that is kind of a parlor game. People play with presidents, have played with Trump and Biden because they're older and because they're so unpopular. With Trump, I never thought it would actually happen. Biden, it could. I mean, there are, you know, there's no obvious person who is popular who could step in. But, you know, it's not impossible. But Biden has said it's not true. He's running. He's planning to run.
Yeah. And he would be, what, 82?
I think 81.
81.
I think he's already our oldest. He was our oldest president coming into office. So I think he'd be the oldest president to run for reelection.
Okay, to your beat, which is to document where the money goes when it comes to Donald Trump. So for people sending donations to Donald Trump, and I get the announcements every day on my phone saying, why haven't you given yet? Where does that money go? When you send money to the Trump organization, where does that money go?
Well, you're sending money, I don't think, to the company. You're probably sending, unless you're buying like Trump candles for Christmas, which in case is fine. But if you're sending money to his political operation, you're giving it to one of these PACs. And basically, it's a giant pile of money that he is sitting on. He is not really doing anything with it at this point, other than spending a little money to raise more money. He's just got this giant war chest that he doesn't seem to be doing.
How giant? How much money are we talking about?
Well, I mean, the last numbers we have are from July, so they're kind of outdated. But it was more than $100 million then, and he's supposedly been raising $1 or $2 million a week off those solicitations you're getting.
Mm-hmm. And so does the Republican National Committee have any control over that, or do they get a cut of it, or any claim on it?
No. It's his money. It's a PAC. It's the kind of PAC that has very little strings attached. So he can, you know, I think he does raise money for the RNC, but this money that I've been talking about, that is his to control. He can give it to the RNC if he wants, but so far he hasn't.
Okay, so for people who would rather have their money go to the RNC, is there a special way to a special site you go to, or how does that work?
If you want to just give to their, I mean, there's a million ways to give to Republican campaign committees, Republican Senate committees, but you can also just give straight to the RNC. I think you just go to RNC.com.
Now, is he, for the money that is in the Trump PAC, can he use that for his legal expenses?
He can. He can. He basically could pay himself $1 million a month. I mean, I think he, he can't like buy cocaine with it, or you know, buy like illegal arms or something. But like he can basically, he can't break the law with it, but he can do almost anything you want with it. There's almost no restrictions on that money. It's much different than a campaign. Once he says, I'm running for president, here is my campaign, there's a lot of restrictions on that. A PAC, there's almost no restrictions.
Okay, so now do you know if he is using his money for his legal expenses?
You know, we don't, because his PAC, is the way it reports, it's required to report its spending and raising. It only does it, I think, every half a year. So we haven't had numbers since July and won't until later this year. So far, we haven't seen it. But we had a story this morning or last night that the RNC is paying Trump's personal legal expenses in the investigation of his business by the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan DA. These are investigations that have nothing to do with Trump's time as president, with his campaigns, completely separate from politics. It's just about his business. But the RNC is paying Trump's legal bills anyway. And their logic is, well, you know, A, he asked us to, and B, he's a leader of our party, and these are Democrats that are investigating him, so he needs our help.
I see. So, but that's legal.
It's uncommon, and a lot of these things are sort of untested area of law. This is very uncommon. The one way it could be illegal or it could cause a legal problem is that the RNC is technically a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And one thing that all nonprofits are not allowed to do is to spend money to help personally, to help their leaders. And so if it seems like there is some, you know, this nonprofit is being abused for the private benefit of Donald Trump, who's the leader of the RNC, you know, somebody could contest its nonprofit status. But it doesn't seem to be illegal under campaign finance law.
Okay, to some of the investigations still going on here. One of them has to do with the valuation of Trump's property, which is something that we've read a lot about. What I want to find out from you is Trump being targeted just for being Trump? Or are these property valuations something that every rich real estate investor does from time to time because they're allowed to under the law?
Well, we haven't seen the full scope of the evidence the AG has, obviously. So I can't give you everything they have. But we were really interested in trying to figure that out. I mean, is Trump being targeted for things that everybody in the world of real estate does? Because we all know real estate, there's some element of puffery and exaggeration. So we talked to some appraisers, a bunch of appraisers, and said, you know, look, this is the incredibly wide difference in valuations Trump has given for his properties. You know, one building on Wall Street, he said it was worth $16 million for property tax purposes. He told lenders it was worth $527 million, 30 times more.
Yikes.
And the appraiser said, no, that is not a thing people do. You know, there's often some variation in appraisals. It's all a little subjective. But you would never expect somebody to value the same building at the same time for two numbers that far apart.
Okay, so I mean, because buildings like that, office buildings, are valued based on the amount of rent they can collect. So if it was valued, let's say, during the Great Recession at one thing, once the recession was over, the value would skyrocket. You're saying this was for the exact same time period?
Or the difference of a couple of months.
Couple of months.
Maybe 6 months. So it was the same building, the same tenants. There was nothing materially different about the economy or the building between those two huge valuations.
Hmm. Well, that would seem to be a very large discrepancy. But again, is it illegal, or is he getting advice from lawyers who are still members of the bar saying that this is okay?
I think the last thing point you raised about Trump's lawyers is going to be the key if they are going to make a criminal case. What we've been told is that, yes, it is a defense. If you made statements, you know, you signed paperwork about these valuations, but you were just trusting your lawyers. You said, you know, my lawyers or these appraisers I hired told me this, and I, you know, who was I to question it? I just signed their paperwork. That's a defense. But if you lied to those appraisers, if you misled your lawyers, if there's a paper trail showing that you actually, instead of relying on them for advice, use them as a screen to hide a misdirection or a misleading filing. If you lied to them, that can be evidence of intent to mislead, which is really important under New York law. I don't know if Trump did that, but that seems to be the kind of thing that the prosecutors here are looking at.
David Farenthold joining us live from the Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.